from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. When a reporter walks into the newsroom in the morning, what they'll tackle for the day is usually determined by the assignment editor. But what if you're an obituary writer? In that case, the saying goes, your assignment editor is God. In the next hour forum, we'll talk with three reporters about the art of writing obituaries, a craft that demands what all journalists strive for, a good story, whether that's writing about the death of a president or the produce manager at the local grocery store. In the hour ahead, obits ranging from the death of a Tuskegee Airman to the death of the Twinkie. Next on forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. This is the time of year when we often think about those who've passed away, about who that person was and what was distinctive about his or her life. But if your job is to write obituaries, the task of summing up a life is an everyday activity. Sometimes those obits are about people we all know, presidents, sports stars, celebrities, sometimes about people we've never heard of, and sometimes they're about an icon. Consider the death of the Twinkie in this obituary from the Washington Post. Twinkies, the unpretentious, freakishly versatile, and seemingly indestructible snack pastry, died Friday of complications from economic reality. Adam Bernstein of the Washington Post wrote that obituary. He joins us this morning along with two other obit writers as we consider the art of obituary writing and what is involved in telling a good story about someone's life. Adam Bernstein, obituaries editor of the Washington Post. Good morning.
Great pleasure to be here. Good morning to you.
Thanks for being with us. Kay Powell joins us as well. She is the former obituary editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Kay Powell, good morning.
Good morning, and good morning, Adam.
Hi, Kay.
And Bruce Weber is here, too, reporter and obituary writer for the New York Times and also the author of a baseball book, As They See Him, A Fan's Travels in the Land of Umpires, and a book about crossing America by bicycle, Life is a Wheel, to be published in the year 2013. Bruce Weber, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. And you know, it's interesting to read your other credits, a book about baseball and a book about bicycling. And it brings to mind, really, the point that the writing a good obituary, Bruce Weber, is really about telling a good story.
Well, I certainly hope so. You know, as most obituary writers will tell you, you get rid of the news in an obituary in the first sentence. Somebody has died. The rest of your job is to tell the story of the life that was lived in as compelling a narrative as you can put together.
Give us an example. We've asked each of you three to pull a couple of your favorites from years past. And Bruce Weber, why don't you get us started by reading a paragraph or two from something that you think does what a good obituary should do?
All right. Well, let's see. This is the obituary of a man named Martin K. Tytel that very few people listening are going to be familiar with. But he was very distinctive career. Martin Tytel, whose unmatched knowledge of typewriters was a boon to American spies during World War II, a tool for the defense lawyers for Alger Hiss, and a necessity for literary luminaries and perhaps tens of thousands of everyday scriveners who asked him to keep their Royals, Underwoods, Olivettis, and computer-resistant pride intact, died on Thursday in the Bronx. He was 94. When he retired in 2000, Mr. Tytel had practiced his recently vanishing craft for 70 years. For most of that time, he rented, repaired, rebuilt, reconfigured, and restored typewriters in a second-floor shop at 116 Fulton Street in Lower Manhattan, where a sign advertised psychoanalysis for your typewriter. There at the Tytel Typewriter Company, he often worked 7 days a week, wearing a white lab coat and a bow tie, catering to customers like the writers Dorothy Parker and Richard Condon, the newsman David Brinkley and Harrison Salisbury, and the political opponents Dwight D. Eisenhower and Adlai E. Stevenson. letters addressed only to Mr. Typewriter New York arrived there, too. Mr. Tytel worked on typewriters that could reproduce dozens of different alphabets appropriate for as many as 145 different languages and dialects, including Farsi and Serbo-Croatian, Thai and Korean, Coptic and Sanskrit, and ancient and modern Greek. He often said that he kept 2 million typefaces in stock.
Let's hold you there, if I might.
Sure.
What's so wonderful about that is all of the detail, from the different typefaces to letters addressed only to Mr. Typewriter New York. Is that sort of one of the keys in this art to get those very specific details, which are the essence of a good story?
Well, sure. I mean, detail is what reporters look for and what writers look for. And I think, obviously, in a life such as the one that I was describing, the details are, they're the whole story. They're because of how arcane what the man was doing.
If I could jump in for one second.
Yeah, Adam Bernstein, go ahead.
I think one of the crucial aspects of writing obituaries is that you have to try and find ways to avoid the kind of cloying traditional narrative that one expects. And I think the best obituaries are the ones that that really help readers not anticipate what the obituary is going to be, where it's going to go. You don't want a predictable narrative. You want the vivid details that, for example, that Bruce just described, ideally with a sense of humor about it so that readers are captivated and want to continue reading.
I stole your opening line from your obituary, Adam Bernstein, of the Twinkie. You want to continue with that, or do you want to select from one of your
Why don't I stay away from the pastries and go into two people that really fascinated me? I mean, these were written a little while ago, but two different ways that I tried to convey try to provide some critical insight into a life and perhaps get to the essence of the person. The first, I'll try and keep it very brief. It was an obituary for one of my favorite filmmakers of all time, Billy Wilder, and basically just said that he wooed his future wife with a line that could have been from one of his films. "I'd worship the ground you walk on if you lived in a better neighborhood." And you want to try and give the voice of the, in my view anyway, you try and want to give the voice, the sense of the person, not so much insert yourself as the writer, but really let them guide you through the story. And once you find a line like that or an anecdote that really makes the person vivid, if you've never, you know, with Wilder, whom I've heard of, or if it's somebody that you know, like Bruce is describing, that I never would have known about, you do a lot of research, you try and come across the anecdotes, the details that really make you as a writer sit up and go, wow, this guy is great, and it lets it pull you into the story so that you can then process it and put it together in a way that captivates readers and makes them want to wish they had known about them when they were still alive. And the other story that I'd like to read from is about a man named Edward von Kloberg III, which was not his real name, and it goes like this. "As part of Washington's image machinery for more than two decades, Edward von Kloberg III did his best to sanitize some of the late 20th century's most notorious dictators as they sought favors and approval from U.S. officials. A legend of sorts in public relations circles, he counted his clients Saddam Hussein of Iraq, Samuel K. Doe of Liberia, Nicolae Ceausescu of Romania, the military regime in Burma, Mobutu Sese Seko of the former Zaire, and in a figurative coup of his own, the man who overthrew Mobutu and renamed the country the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Von Kloberg embraced the slogan, 'Shame is for sissies,' as well as an unabashedly Edwardian style of living. He arrived at balls and galas wearing black capes, and he traveled with steamer trunks. He added the Von to his name because he thought it sounded distinguished. In a life full of flamboyance, the end followed form. He leapt to his death Sunday from a castle in Rome." And just finally here, "Washington is a city full of advocates and image enhancers, but only a few have staked their reputations as representatives of despots, dictators, and human rights violators. For von Kloberg, the job was a social exercise as well as an all-consuming effort. As he wooed potential clients, he often highlighted his own bad press. There was a lot."
And Adam Bernstein, didn't he contact you before he passed away as an effort to sort of woo you a little bit on the kind of obit you might wear?
True. It's rare, I think, that people go out of their way to contact newspapers. It's not that it's never happened so much as it's fairly rare that people
generally people who are not really worthy of newspaper obituary.
Right. Very true. There's an insecurity at the end, I guess, where people who would feel like they're not going to rate an obit might call up and say, "Hey, do you have something on me on file?" And you know, and usually the answer is, "Who are you?"
Right.
Actually, that was the case of von Klobrig. I'd never heard of him before, but I remember sitting there and getting a call, and you know, I was in the middle of work, so I was, you know, I was trying to get the person to come to the point, and he had this strangely Noel Coward-like voice. It was totally affected. It was, "Oh, hello, dear boy." And this guy was from New Jersey, and I just said, "Yes, can I help you?" And he said, "Well, have you ever heard of Edward von Klobrig?" And I said, "No." And because I'm a friend of his, and it clearly was him, and I would like to see if you would ever, how does one go about doing these sort of things? And meanwhile, I was trying to keep him on the line. I was trying to perhaps get him off the line, and I just did a quick search on my computer, and every reference to him was the notorious Edward von Klobrig, the despicable, and suddenly I was intrigued, because
right.
as most of us probably know, you know, most people aren't that worthy of doing the advance obituary. There's a predictability to a lot of what we do, and suddenly my brain perked up, and I just said, "Hold the line, and let me just do a little bit more research, and how can I get back to you?" And the more I worked, the more I looked into his life, the crucial thing was to go back to him and say, "Yes, I'd love to meet you," with the understanding that I don't want to hear how horribly misunderstood you are. I want to kind of get the idea of what motivated you to get into this business, and perhaps tell me some things that haven't been written about before.
Adam Bernstein, the obituaries editor at the Washington Post, joining us along with Bruce Weber at the New York Times and Kay Powell, the former obituary editor at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and hence the story of Edward von Klobrig. And Kay Powell, tell us one of your stories, because you've done a lot of writing of obituaries of people even less known than either the Mr. Typewriter or Edward von Klobrig.
Yes, we took a very different approach before I retired from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. We specifically wanted a very democratic obits page, and because of the placement in the paper, people knew they were dead. So we usually dropped the death graph several, you know, way down in the story. I think it's important, besides the details they mention, an obit should capture the personality, bring them back to life. It's about how they lived, not how they died. And I think also gives you a sense of time and place. I wrote on Claude Miller. He was either 104 or 107, depending on whether you believe the family Bible or Social Security.
Which did you choose to believe?
Well, the family went with Social Security, but I also put an explanation in there about the date of his birth that the family Bible recorded.
Why don't you read us the first few paragraphs, if you would, of Claude Miller's.
Thank you, I will. Claude Miller started his day with some fried streakaline or fatback and a homemade buttered biscuit with brown sugar on it. Then he set out for a day of working at a sawmill, making moonshine, and bootlegging on the side. Mr. Miller's schoolhouse was the sawmill. His education was how to take a one-hand bucksaw, fell a tree, and cut off every single limb till it was smooth as butter. And his daughter-in-law, whom I interviewed for the article, said, "You could rub the wood and not get a splinter." Now, his specialty was apple brandy and peach brandy, and he was a moonshiner, I think, over 43 years. But she told me, too, I mean, honestly, Dave, I shouldn't take credit for this story. It wrote itself. She was such a good interview. She said, "He was only in jail one time. They blew his still up in 1965, but he didn't go to jail for that. It was a different time he was in jail for bootlegging."
I think the paper should have had you read all of these aloud, Kay Powell. That brings a different quality of storytelling to them. Let's talk for a moment about this question of who gets an obituary, because we've heard actually three people probably no one listening to has heard of, some perhaps more notable, the Von Klobergs or the Mr. Typewriter than our friend Claude Miller. But what about this question, Bruce Weber, of who gets an obituary, particularly in a paper like yours, the Times?
Well, I think as Kay was pointing out, there are a lot of different ways to go about obits in a given paper. The Times chooses to write about I suppose what we call newsworthy people. If you made news in life, then we will choose to think of your death as a newsworthy event. That doesn't entirely explain how we choose. I think there's a collection of the Times obits that comes out annually. It has for the last couple of years. And in the introduction, my editor Bill McDonald has written that the numbers of people who die every day in the world is something like 55,000, or no, it's got to be more than that. Anyway, the percentage, we have millions of people to choose from, and we publish about 1,300 obits a year. There is no hard and fast rule, but basically it is the life of the person we're going to write about. Will it be pertinent to a general general readership? We often hear from people who wonder why this fantastic doctor or a businessman who ran several companies or a junior senator from Kentucky doesn't make the grade, but a guy who worked in a typewriter shop does. And really, the only thing we can the only answer we have to that is, well, we think that the guy who worked in the typewriter shop will be more pertinent, more interesting, and more enriching to our readers than those others.
Bruce, that was exactly my mantra to my writers and to me also. Important does not equate to interesting.
Right.
And we were looking for a good story for our readers, and these are written for the readers every day.
And Adam Bernstein, how does that apply to something like the Twinkie, speaking of enriching our lives? Because that particular obituary has gone viral and gotten lots of interest.
Well, let me explain that Twinkies was sort of a one-off piece. It's not. I'm not looking for food items.
You're not going to do ring-dings and ho-hos?
Right, although it probably would bring in the kind of readers that we were looking for. But I think that, the Twinkies is done as a bit of a lark, not by my desk so much as our, what we call our style section, which is arts and entertainment and sort of a reverent page. And they tapped me to do it. But that's a very, it's the first time and probably only time I'll do something like that. I generally stick to the to human beings.
I did the obit for Pluto the planet, and it was 1A story because of the timing we were. Anyway, that's the one that people will come up to me and mention, but Adam is exactly right. You can only use that device once.
Right. So, but let me explain. Our policy is a little bit different, and we don't quite have the discretion that both the New York Times and Atlanta Journal-Constitution have in choosing subjects. Way above my pay grade, it was decided that we would cover every single Washingtonian who died, nearly every single Washingtonian, and that amounts to about 2,000 to 3,000 obituaries a year, just for government bureaucrats and church volunteers and members of the business community in our suburbs. And we have to do them. They're not necessarily elaborate by any means, but they are factual landmines. And so a lot of our effort has gone into putting that on our page. And I have a team of about 2 full-time reporters. So in addition to just trying to get through that kind of mountain of humanity, we also need to be prepared on the obvious, front page newsmakers and non-front page newsmakers. And then beyond that, it's really discretionary. I very much like arts and entertainment figures, and as well as iconoclasts and people who just sort of speak to me personally. I like, for example, earlier this year we did a woman who was involved in civil rights activism in Montgomery several years before the bus boycott, but played a crucial role in setting the groundwork for that, as well as a woman who was a heroine of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, but not only that, but also wrote a very early book, an account of what she had witnessed. So there are aspects of those lives that, you know, that we don't necessarily have to write, but really spoke to me, and I thought gave something a little bit extra to our readers.
Adam Bernstein, obituaries editor for The Washington Post. I'd like to ask you each something about how obituary writing has changed, not just stylistically, but also what you can say and how that has changed. First, on the question of things that are taboos, has that changed or is that changing? Suicide, for example, Kay Powell, is that something you can now say or not? AIDS is something that's changed over time. Where are we with certain facts that are sometimes reluctant to, we're reluctant to write and to read?
At the Atlanta Journal-Constitution in the obituary section, we did write about suicide. Now, as we wrote about people who had died, and my sort of benchmark for deciding was, if I was curious to know more about them, then the reader would be. These are people, there was no news hook. They were usually private people. There was no reason for the paper to be writing about them. So if they were that kind of private person, we got the family's permission. We did write about suicides. The family would have to give their permission for us to say it was suicide. We wouldn't necessarily go into a lot of gruesome detail on how the suicide took place. It was just done in passing. Some families were happy to have us do it because it might be somebody who was bipolar and wasn't taking their meds. They felt like there was an object lesson there that would benefit other people. So we wrote about suicides. We also, again, with the permission of the partner or the family, write about, identify people as gay. We did not out people, but a lot of times they wanted people to know, or you could tell from the activities and all they were involved in that they were. We did not specifically mention race in an article, but when I'd write about a Tuskegee Airman, then you'd know he was. It was sort of a level playing field for everybody. And I think only one time did I have a family say no to writing about a suicide. And the mother told me, she said, it's early. I think it was a homicide, not a suicide. And I really don't want to see suicide in print before we know for sure. So I didn't write about that person.
Kay Powell, the former obituary editor for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. She joins us along with Bruce Weber of the New York Times and Adam Bernstein of the Washington Post as we talk about the art of obituary writing. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll talk more about some of the things you can or perhaps can't write about, some also about the notable passing of individuals from the year 2012, and we'll hear some more examples of obituary writing from each of our three writers this morning. We'd like to hear from you, too. What would you like said about you, written about you in your obituary? You can join our conversation at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can email us at form@kqed.org, or you can post your thoughts or comments on our Facebook page or on our website. We'll talk more about obituary writing, about what makes a life worth noting, and what we ought to remember about those lives when we return. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, obituary writing, the art of writing about someone's life as well as their death. You can join our conversation at 866-733-6786. We were talking right before the break about how times have changed to a degree in terms of what you can write about, which was perhaps once more difficult to do on the question of suicide and also the question of gay relationships. This came up recently with the obituary of the astronaut Sally Ride, in which the family released at the time of Sally Ride's death a reference to her partner. How do you contend with that kind of question at the Times, Bruce Weber?
Well, generally, since we're writing about newsmakers, we considered obituaries to be part of the news sections. So there really isn't anything that that is off limits. At the same time, you know, we don't go out of our way to be offensive or to publish information, particularly at the time of a death, that's going to embarrass the family. Most of the time, in terms of the gay issue, most of the time I found that families are eager to have the mm-hmm. partners or the partners of the deceased acknowledged. So I haven't really run into that problem very much. From time to time, I'll have a family decline or to tell me the cause of death, or ask me not to publish the cause of death, for reasons that are usually entirely private to the family, because I rarely understand why people find that embarrassing. But sometimes they do, and I will often try to persuade them to allow me to use it, because just generally in as a journalist, I you know, you can't unring a bell. Once you know a fact, you know a fact, and I don't really want to keep it from readers, but you know, I also use a certain amount of personal discretion in trying to judge, you know, how painful is this going to be for the person that I'm talking to on the phone.
It's interesting, this question of that generally people are eager to talk. And I was reading an article yesterday, Adam Bernstein, by an obituary writer who said that, you know, people think that it's the hardest thing in the world must be to call the widow to find out more about that person, and that actually is not. That people are eager for that opportunity to say something about the person they love. Has that been your experience?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's a matter of being publicly recognized, and if an obituary appears in you know, Washington Post or New York Times or Atlanta Journal Constitution or whatever the hometown paper is, or a national newspaper, then people are usually very cooperative. For us, we have two policies that sometimes make people a little bit more sensitive about it. We always account for all marriages, which can be a you know, a tricky place to go, but you know, unless it's a private individual, in which case we just tell them we can't run the obituary, we really insist on accounting for all marriages. We view marriage as a major event and a milestone in somebody's life, and we can't just erase a life from the narrative of the person. You know, for 99% of the time, people are eager to chat, talk about the lives, provide us with further details. You know, just to double check what's already been reported as well. Often you'll find that you know, what may have appeared in a profile might be slightly inaccurate. So it's just an opportunity to correct the record in some cases, or at least to balance out the record and put something together that will ideally stand the test of time. I mean, the appeal of obituaries really is that when so much news comes across as ephemera, obituaries still matter. It's the one story that people generally keep, and that's sort of the pleasure of doing what we do, I think.
Yeah. I want to ask you some about how the field may be changing with the advent of more material online, with social media, and the use of voice and video as well. And by way of getting into that, I want to play a little bit of audio that you referenced, Adam, and something you wrote, the origin actually is from the New York Times. And this is a video that Art Buchwald recorded before his passing, which has one of the all-time great opening lines. Okay. We're working on finding that. Sorry, we'll have to hold that moment and play that in a moment. But as we get to that subject, Adam Bernstein, do you want to describe something about how things are changing with social media, with online? Because even though you represent in the paper one aspect of the paper that's still very coveted and read, as you were observing, there are these other places now where you can find these.
Well, I mean, the biggest thing for me is how social media has changed who is really worthy of a staff written obituary. The eye-opening moment for me was a starlet named Brittany Murphy, who she happened to have died on a weekend when I wasn't on duty, and she was never a first-tier star. She, to me, sort of represented a bit of unfulfilled promise, and you know, she never really said anything memorable about her craft. There was, to me, not a heck of a lot there. However, she was very young, and the people who you know, the sort of young social media types were really just responding wildly to her death. And there was this mass push at my newspaper saying, haven't you prepared anything? And I'm like, who? I mean, first of all, I had to figure out who they were talking about. And these, you know, to me, it's sort of the young social networkers who are really driving traffic and the idea that we're all just sort of trending topics that we're following. There's sort of a mad rush to put out an elaborate story on people who may not be have traditionally been worthy of long or staff written obituaries.
That's an interesting the subject of sort of pop stars who are self-destructive is an interesting one on Obit's desks. We often talk about whether or not we ought to be preparing something on one of these, you know, on the Amy Winehouses and Britney Spearses and Lindsay Lohans of the world who seem to be spiraling out of control. And I always tend to be against it, mainly because, first of all, you don't want to feel like you're encouraging some kind of wish fulfillment. But the other thing is that a lot of these people, as time goes on, if they don't die now, if Lindsay Lohan were suddenly to expire, and I'm not suggesting that I want that to happen by any means, it would be big news. But the longer she lives, the shorter her obit is going to be. And to me, it's a really interesting question about whether or not this is the best use of an obituary writing time.
I want to come back to this question of advance obit writing in a moment, but I want to let's stay for a moment on this question of how social media has changed things. And joining us to give us an additional perspective on that, Krishna Undavulu, who is the editor of Obit magazine, which examines life through the lens of death. Krishna, thanks for calling in and joining our program as well. Are you with us, Krishna?
And
if you would say something about how things have changed in terms of the way in which the online world and social media make the obituary something that is more shared and interactive.
Sure. I mean, I think when you think about the way people are reading obituaries or what they're using obituaries to say about themselves, social media has changed maybe what before internet was, before the internet sort of came about, was an introspective act of reading about someone else's life and comparing that life to yourself, your own, but also understanding how that life story intersected with your life history.
Give us an example. Like you referenced, I know, the case of the children's writer Maurice Sendak.
Sure. So when he died, my Facebook feed sort of blew up with people saying RIP Maurice Sendak, and either linking to an obituary or maybe sharing a thought about how that book, Where the Wild Things Are, influenced their life growing up. So instead of maybe keeping that sentiment to themselves and understanding how Maurice Sendak, as someone who created a great work of literature, influenced them, they were able to perform for their social media circle and say, this is a person who's integral to my life. And I'm honoring that person by saying RIP and linking to an obituary, but I'm also saying something about myself. And I think that's kind of the performative act that sharing an obituary has become on social media.
Krishna Undavulu, managing editor of Obit magazine. Stay with us as our conversation continues. It reminds me in a way, and this is before the advent of social media in many ways, I suppose, Bruce Weber, but what happened with the Portraits of Grief series that the Times ran after 9/11. Has those sorts of capsule summaries of someone's life and this question of sharing and making this a more interactive experience, is that something that's really changing?
Well, I certainly think that social media is changing journalism in all sorts of ways. I'm not quite sure how it's changing the work that I do, except to maybe make me more aware of people reading my work, because they write me letters, and they when the stories are open for comments, they comment. You mentioned the Portraits of Grief, which was just a fantastic thing that our newspaper did. I wish I could say I participated in it, but I didn't. For listeners who don't know, it was after 9/11. The Times did little portraits of all 3,000 of the New Yorkers who died in the Twin Towers. Contacted all the families and wrote little two or three paragraph summaries of their lives and personalities. They weren't, in a sense, obituaries, because there was no sort of analysis. There was no kind of perspective on the lives. They were sort of anguished memorials. Here was a person who liked this, who played the harmonica and who delighted friends and family with antics in front of the TV set. They were terribly, terribly moving. And we received thousands and thousands of letters of gratitude for our doing this.
They remind me in a way of sort of what you hear on the StoryCorps segments on public radio, and this question of sort of getting a real sense of what someone's life was and what is going to be lost. And it reminds me too, Kay Powell, of I'm just going to read, if I might, the first paragraph of one you wrote for a woman named Thelma Hogan, I'll just read this first paragraph. At Matthew's cafeteria, a smiling Thelma Hogan called you by your first name, asked you after your mama, made sure your cornbread was cooked just like you like it, and hugged your child in her lap while she rang up your lunch on the cash register. She did that about 800 times a day for 43 years. I should have had you read it. I don't know why I read it. You have such a lovely
you
voice.
You did fine.
but speak to us, Kay Powell, about those kinds of stories, because they are, and what makes them so worth noting?
Bruce, I always said, you tell a good story honestly. That's what I drilled into my writers. Mm-hmm. And it amazed me what readers would respond to, what hit a responsive chord with them. And everybody could find something to identify with in somebody that we wrote about. And it just amazed me how that would come about and how they'd respond. And families would blow up these obit articles and display them on an easel at the funeral, and they'd bury people with copies of our obit about them, their article about them, and they laminate them and make bookmarks for their Bibles out of it. And I want people to understand, we wrote about extraordinarily accomplished people, but when I go back to talking about capturing the personality, giving you a sense of place and time, I think both Thelma Hopkins and Claude Miller do that. And that's why, in a way, I'm a little bit like Bruce. I'm old school. I like that personal interview, not just with the family, but with friends, because so many reporters now are relying on email interviews. And I think you lose the spontaneity. I think you lose wonderful quotes. I just think it's very stifling. It's like Adam said earlier, a lot of obits, you read the first sentence or paragraph, and you know what the whole rest of the story is going to say. And it's through that personal discussion. And families would tell us, I mean, the newsroom never could understand why there was so much laughter coming out of the obit desk. And families would tell us, it's wonderful in this horrible grieving time to remember nice things and fun things and sweet things. And we worked on a daily deadline. We came in the morning checked through all the information we had, decided on whom we were going to write, and by 5 o'clock had finished that piece, done 6 interviews or more, fact-checked it, gotten 2 photos to go with it, and moved it to the line editor. Because it's sort of a more local newspaper, we treated these as news articles. We wanted them in the paper before the funeral because that's an important part of the news. And we'd have families call us back and say, there were 300 people at Daddy's funeral, and we didn't think but about 50 would come. And preachers loved them, too, because people they didn't know very well. We'd have staff members or others come back.
You did
back
the work of the preacher. Yeah. Yeah.
Come back from the funeral and say, Kate, the preacher used your obit for his eulogy. Everything he said was pulled right from your article. So there's a broad base of support and appreciation, and I agree the families are cooperative, and if they're not, if it's not important enough, skip over it. If there's somebody who must be written about, then you've just got to do without it after you. Like when I wrote on the Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan, I guarantee you his wife and his son did not want that article written.
Right.
And I talked to them until I finally let them know that it was going to be a fair article. It would cover what he had done after that and so forth. And I just talked myself blue in the face. And when I hung up, I got a standing ovation from the newsroom because I had convinced them to do that article. And it was a great one, too.
And we should wish we had that from us. If you can rummage around and find it, we'll get that on, too. But
the King of All the World's Gypsies was another one. The family sent me a picture of him in his coffin.
And let me ask you to hang on just for a moment, Kay Powell, because I want to get Krishna Andavulu back into this, because this question of sharing these stories is what you're really trying to do and extend that conversation so that it's not just between the family and including the preacher, but including a lot more in that broader conversation about who someone was.
Right. So, the conversation that is always sort of happening between the living and the dead, I think, has now been extended towards the social media space. And so you can sort of say something about yourself by posting the obituary of someone that you admired, but you can also add to what that legacy meant by adding comments, by going to sort of like memorial websites, and really sort of be involved with that conversation. And it's fine. And so it's a new venue for something I think that's pretty inherently human, which is thinking about the lives of people who came before us, and how that makes us strive to do better, to learn from mistakes, to laugh, to do any number of these things.
I want to play. Earlier we were going to hear from the obit from Art Buchwald that Adam Bernstein, you drew my attention to, this idea of including someone's voice, and this gets us also back to the subject of advanced obit writing. But let's hear what Art Buchwald had to say.
Hi, I'm Art Buchwald. I just died.
A line from Art Buchwald. There's more besides that one line, but it is a great line, Bruce Weber, from the times where that originated. Are you doing more of those kinds of those capturing of those before someone passes?
Yes, that's a feature on our website. Called The Last Word. There are a number of them that you can find on our website. Miriam Makeba, I know, did one. Bob Feller did one. I can give you a list. There are about a dozen up there now, and I believe that we've done interviews, video interviews with several prominent people. I'm not allowed to tell you who they are, but obviously we can't put them up until the time.
Right. You were talking, Bruce Weber, before about this question of advanced writing and the question of whether you do one for a Britney Spears or a Lindsay Lohan. And I'm wondering now, for example, with the questions about the serious health problems that are confronting former President George H.W. Bush. In that sort of circumstance, do you now go back to that file? I'm sure that is one that's been...
Oh, yeah, that's been written for quite a while. And, yeah, this happens sort of all the time. We've got a file at this point of about 1,500 advance obits, and we're constantly... sort of desperately and usually in a panic trying to go through them and make sure that they're as up to date as they can be, when especially when we hear of something like the illness of George H.W. Bush. When we have one that is written and a death seems to be closer than let's just say closer than it used to be. Although I suppose you could describe any death that way.
We're all day to day, as the sports saying goes. Yeah.
They come up for polishing and updating, and we try to be ready. I mean, there's a kind of actuarial quality to what we do.
Let me read one that one of our listeners sent in that was a favorite of his, and we'd welcome other callers and comments in the minutes we have remaining on sort of favorite obituaries for one reason or another. But this is one that Steve wrote in that he liked. It was in your paper, Bruce, in the New York Times, about a former football coach at Rutgers. It said that the team had suffered through some tough losses that season. During a game late in the year, three players were injured on the same play. The coach ran out on the field. This is the coach whose obituary was being featured. Coach ran out on the field and said to the three players, "This is embarrassing. Two of you better get up." And they did. Let's hear from a listener. Ken joins us from Alameda. Ken, go ahead.
Mr. Weber, I'm wondering about your criteria for doing advanced research, because I know that you can't compete in them, but your obit page is used in Deadpools, where people try to predict within the next calendar year famous people who will die. And I realize that's ghoulish, but it brings up the question, how do you decide in advance to do your research? Because I know someone who is a minor figure in the film industry who got a call from you or someone on your staff about 10 years ago, and he told me that's how he realized that he was important.
Ken, thanks for the call. Bruce.
Well, there is no science to this. We have long lists of people in a variety of different fields, along with their ages. And usually when somebody gets to be, somebody is prominent and gets to be 70 or 75 or 80, this begins to attract our notice, saying, if this person were to die, on deadline tonight, what would we do? Really, the idea of an advance obit is simply so that we're prepared when the time comes. And the people that we write obits, advance obits for, are generally people for whom we think it'd take more than a day to write the obit.
Ken, thanks for the call. Adam Bernstein, here's a question that perhaps you can take from Emily. There was an obit in Florida recently where one surviving child used that venue to speak negatively about his siblings. Have you ever dealt with family members wanting to use the obit as an opportunity to get their resentments expressed?
Personally, no. However, I do know that we did have an obituary once for a man. I didn't write it, but a colleague of mine did. And he received a call the next day from the ex-wife saying, "You've been much too kind." we wouldn't allow something like that to happen. It's not a forum for families to take out their anger or their frustrations. It might be a paid death notice that they're talking about. Sometimes you've come across... I've come across stories of people taking somebody dies and they use the paid notice to castigate a ne'er do well son or something to that effect. We wouldn't allow it. It's just not in good taste at all.
Let's hear next from Anne in Sausalito. Anne, go ahead.
In 1994, my former husband died, and we had been young in Cambridge. And it was a hard death, and my children lost a father very young. And I thought on their behalf it would be great to have an obit, so I wrote one. And there was a news hook. We were quite active in those days in 1970 in the radical world in Cambridge. And I wrote the obit, and I called the Globe, and I talked with them. And what the guy said, who was the obit person I talked to, was, "Lady, you got to have a news hook." And he didn't think that my radical stories of sitting in our living room with Howard Zinn were an adequate news hook. So we didn't get it. And I would say this, that it would have meant the world to my children to have the very best of their father known to their old community. Hmm.
Yeah, and thank you for that thought. And that's, of course, the dilemma that all of you face. We just have a moment left. So Kay Powell, what would you say to Anne?
I would say that what she had written was more properly published as a paid death notice by the family. I, as a reporter, might take a look at it and say, radical, died young, might be a story here, but it would have to give all aspects of his life. If there were arrests, if there were illegal things he'd done, matters of, that would have to be in it too. It's not a eulogy, it's not a biography, it's a news story. And our job as reporters is not to leave the reader asking questions, but to answer those questions. So the way she wrote it, it was more properly, I think, a paid death notice from the family.
I have to leave our conversation there. We're out of time. I want to thank all of you for the writing you do and the memories that you create and the honesty and fairness with which you tell those stories. Kay Powell, former obituary editor for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Kay Powell, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Dave. I've enjoyed it, and I've enjoyed sharing this with my colleagues.
Adam Bernstein, obituaries editor of the Washington Post. Adam, thank you.
Thank you, Dave.
And Bruce Weber, reporter and writer and author of the New York Times. Bruce Weber, thanks for being with us as well.
Thanks, Dave. Thank you, Adam. Thank you, Jay.
Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi and Judy Campbell, with additional producing help this week from Vinny Tong and also from Suki Lewis. Our engineer is Howard Gelman. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum at KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.